Jewish audio on Chabad.org.
Okay, so today, as we continue the telling of the story, which is the primary mitzvah for the night of the Seder, but we have to tell the story. That's what Magid means, to tell. So we're going to tell the story of how the Jewish people begin to experience slavery, persecution, and all kinds of terrible things. But very interestingly, the story, the introduction to the story of the Jewish people's sinking into slavery and deprivation is all about the story of our growth. That's how the story begins. The story begins with contrasts of how we started and contrasts of how we left. And the beginning of all the bad stuff is actually that we prospered nonetheless, which is very compelling. So let's take it from the top. The paragraph we're going to begin today starts with the word bimsei me'ot. Bimsei me'ot means that very, very small or few in number. That was the beginning of the saga of the Jewish people. We leave Mitzrayim, we leave as a nation. We began the exile 210 years before the Exodus, not as a nation, but as a family. A large family. But nation, that terminology doesn't apply. Bimsei me'ot, shenemar, as it is written, b'shivim nafesh. It says, with 70 souls. Now, it's important for us to understand that whenever we have a quote, a scriptural quote, in the writings of our sages, they can be for one of two reasons. One is to prove that it is so. It is so, for so it is written, shenemar. Another is, it's not to prove it, but rather simply to reference the story. And the Rebbe maintains that in this situation, the intention of the Baal HaGadah, the Masadr HaGadah, is not to prove anything, but rather to use this as a frame and to demonstrate the small beginnings and the extraordinary growth. So, as it is written, not because it is written, Shenemar, as it is written, B'shivim nefesh yardav esecha Mitzrayimah, with 70 souls, your people came down into the land of Mitzrayim. V'ata, and now, Somcha Hashem alikecha kechechvei hashamayim l'reiv. Now Hashem has placed you, or has made you, like the stars in the heavens in such great numbers and in such great multitudes. We mentioned last week, Ramban, who quotes the Zohar and the Medrash, that the number of 70 has a corollary with this proverbial 70 nations. And that's why the number had to be 70. The interesting thing is, though, if you count up the names, you don't get 70. You only get 69. So this is a question. It's a question because it says B'shivim Nefesh, the Torah itself says B'shivim Nefesh, but when we count B'shivim Nefesh, we don't find the 70, we find only 69. And there are, generally speaking, three answers of how we appreciate the notion of, and there were 70. In the Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar, and in some Midrashim, it says that Hashem was with the Jewish people. So that counts for one. You know the story of that there was the Hasidic guy with long payas somewhere like in Montreal, you know, with the Hasidic, and he was driving a motorcycle, and this anti-Semitic police officer couldn't stand the sight of a Jew enjoying himself with his payas flying in a motorcycle, and he followed him for like 20 minutes, and he couldn't find him doing anything wrong. He signals, he stops, he goes, finally he pulls him over, and he says, license and registration. So the Yiddish boy takes out license and registration, he looks at it, he says, I don't understand. He says, I'm following you for 20 minutes. You did everything exactly by the book. The motorcyclist said, of course, Hashem is with me. The police officer said, two people on a motorcycle. So Hashem is always with us. And that's the first lesson that we have to know. We're going into Mitzrayim, that we're not in this alone. There is another approach, and that is the approach of the Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra says, Yaakov Avinu's name is not mentioned. His family is mentioned. His children is mentioned. But Yaakov counts too. And this is all different, but also a very profound lesson. We're not in this alone. We have Hashem's presence with us, but we also have the merit of our ancestors. Our babis and zaydis, our sabot and savtot, we come from very special people. We have a connection, generations back to special people. So we are not in here or on this mission by ourselves. As the famous expression goes, we are kananos agabe anok, we are like a midget who stands on the shoulders of a giant. So that's the second thing we have to know. When we're going into Golos, we're in an exilic situation, we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. Yankev Avinu is with us, our father is with us, the Rebbe, Yankev is Netzutzei, a Nasi, which is the leader of the Jewish people, is an acronym for Netzutzo Shel Yaakov Avinu, spark of Yaakov. We're not in this alone. And amazingly, the Gemara gives a different explanation. The Gemara in Bava Basra, and Rashi quotes this as Pshuto Shel Mikra says, there were 69 people on the journey, but there was one pregnant woman. And that pregnant woman went into labor at customs, Bein HaChemes, just when they were entering Mitzrayim. And her name, this little girl who was born just upon entry, so she was kind of made in Israel, born in Egypt, but just upon the entry, her name was Yocheved. And she later on, 130 years later, gives birth to a child who she names Moshe. Actually, she names him Yedidya. The Egyptian woman who saves him names him Moshe. But she gives birth to Moshe Rabbeinu. And that Moshe Rabbeinu is the leader, is the redeemer of the Jewish people. Now, on one hand, this is very meaningful that we're coming into Mitzrayim, and as we're coming into Mitzrayim, the mother of the Redeemer is born. And that's pretty meaningful. But the Rebbe says, don't just look at it as the mother of the Redeemer is born, because that doesn't happen for another 130 years. Look at it as, who made the Jewish people complete? A little Jewish girl. A little girl. The koyach, the strength, the power of Am Yisrael comes from little children. And especially from a little girl. And we have 70, that's our number, that's the foundation. Once we're at the number 70, we can overcome everything. No matter what they try to do to us, we're going to anyway proliferate. We're anyway going to grow, anyway we're going to succeed. And the Torah chooses specifically a little girl. And the Rebbe says, in many ways, Judaism is a feminine religion. You see, a male is aggressive. That's the nature of males. As it says in the Torah, that zachar darkei lichpish, that the male, he conquers, he subdues, he overcomes. But the nature of woman is much more subtle. Woman nurtures. The woman makes a transformation, but not by sheer force, but rather through her gentle and persuasive abilities. And the Jewish people are supposed to make a difference in the world. That's no question. In fact, the Rebbe maintains that this idea of the 70 nations, which as Ramban and the Rokeach and other Rishonim say is, connect, according to Medrash essentially, connected to the 70 nations. And the Jewish allusion between the 70 elders, which make up the concept of the Sanhedrin. And then with Moshe Rabbeinu and Hashem's presence is 72, which is the name of the tetragram. So all of these, this important foundation of the Jewish people, the Rebbe says this is connected not only to being able to overcome the nations of the world, but rather that we have an obligation to the world. And our obligation to the world is to be an Or LaGoyim, not that we should borrow somebody else's light or be a reflector for somebody else's virtues or somebody else's ethos. That we're supposed to take our virtues, we're supposed to take Torah. We're supposed to take the divine instruction that Hashem gave us, and that should become a beacon for the world. And our job ultimately is to make a difference. Now, for the longest time, not only could we not force Judaism on anybody, we could barely defend ourselves. In fact, most often we could not defend ourselves. And time and again, we unfortunately went through very, very tumultuous and painful and anguish-filled odysseys during our exile. Very difficult times. So how did the Jewish people have an impact? Different faith systems, they implanted themselves on the psyche of societies by the sword. They conquered, they burnt, they pillaged, they killed, they murdered, and that's how they established themselves. I don't have to mention names. Everybody knows exactly what we're talking about. And it's more than one faith system. All just about all the major faith systems that have a global reach did so by the sword. The Judaism never promulgated anything by the point of the sword. First of all, we didn't have a sword. We haven't had a sword since Bar Kokhba, and that's almost 2,000 years. So how did Judaism make such a difference? If you look at the preeminent notions of every decent society, you'll find those ideas traced back to the Torah. How did we do it? How did we have such a big influence? Not in an aggressive fashion, not by forcing anybody. In fact, we don't even look for converts. We avoid converts. It's only the holiest and the most special people who come on their own volition to join us. But we don't try to force anybody. That goes against the tenets of Judaism. The answer is it's in a feminine fashion. By nurturing, by slowly but surely and delicately leaving our imprinture and making a positive difference. So the Rebbe says this is a whole different perspective as most would choose to think. And this is symbolic that the number 70, what created the completion, what created the full foundation for the future, the birth of a little girl, just a few hours old. Coming into Mitzrayim, that's where the Haggadah begins now. B'mseimeot, we're talking here about the Shivim Nefesh. So those Shivim Nefesh, that was the foundation. V'ata, and now, Samcha Hashem Alekecha Kechich V'Hashemayim L'Roiv. Hashem has placed you in this extraordinary fashion in a way which is like the stars in the heaven. Now, when we're talking about this concept of the stars in the heaven, and the contrast, it's interesting to note that this pasuk is not the quotation from the book of Genesis, not the quotation from the Chumash Bereishis, where it says that we came down with 70 nations. This is Moshe Rabbeinu repeating the story of the Jewish people in the 10th chapter of the 5th book of the Torah, Chumash Devarim, right? Which is what we call Deuteronomy. What is Deuteronomy? It's Moshe Rabbeinu's recapping of the four books that precede it, especially beginning with the story of the Jewish people in during their exilic odyssey and their subsequent redemption. So there, Moshe Rabbeinu says, "B'shivim nefesh, with 70 souls, you came down into Mitzrayim. V'ata now, samcha Hashem alekecha." This is a continuation of a verse. So the verse from Devarim is quoted rather than the earlier verse, because that's the verse that has contrast. And whenever we want to make a point, we contrast. That's the pasuk. That's in the Torah, actually. The Torah actually makes this contrast. B'shivim nefesh yardu, and you left, kichaychve hashamayim l'roiv. Now, really, how many Jews were there? That's like a pretty bold statement when you say that it's kichaychve hashamayim l'roiv, that we were as many as the stars in the heaven. Well, the truth is that we were a lot more than most would realize. We tend to think of the Jewish people's numbers as 600,000. Does that sound familiar? 600,000. But really, how many people were 600,000? Males between the age of 20 to 60. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't counted, nor was Aaron, nor was Miriam. Very important people, leaders of the Jewish people. They're not counted. So we only have that specific amount counted. And because of this, it turns out that we don't really talk of 600,000 Jews who left, but rather we talk about, if there were 600,000 men, there were 600,000 women who were in the age from 20 to 60. Okay, so now we're not talking about 600,000, we're talking about 1.2 million. Now, how about all the children, everybody from the age of birth until 20? Medrash says there were 600,000 boys, 600,000 girls. You doing the math? Okay, now we got older people. Moshe Rabbeinu lives till 120. Aaron HaKohen lives till 123. Serach, the daughter of Usher, lived. There were many, many older Jews, many older people who lived far, far beyond, especially the women, the men who made trouble all died because they didn't want to go to Eretz Yisrael, but the women lived. So we're going to go 600,000 now, another two times. Comes out that it's not 600,000, but it's 600,000 times five. That's a lot of people. It gets even better. How many of the Jewish people actually left Mitzrayim? All the Jewish people? No. How many left? Anybody know?
1 in 5.
1 in 5. 1 in 5 is what we call the conservative estimate. And that's because it says the chamushim. And the chamushim we understand to be the concept of 1/5. However, I should tell you that the Medrash says one opinion is echad mechamisha. The yeshemrim, another opinion is echad mechamishim. 1 in 50. That means for every Jew who left Mitzrayim, 49 never left. You think that's a lot? The yeshemrim echad mechamish meyers. For every Jew who left Mitzrayim, 499 got stuck. Died during Makat Choshech. And if that doesn't blow your mind, Rabbi Nahiroi says that 1 of 5,000 left. Which means that the number of the Jewish people who left Mitzrayim was only 1/5,000th of the amount of Jewish people that were available for redemption. Now, unfortunately, the vast majority of the Jewish people did not want to go. The question only is how big that vast majority was. Whether it was 1/5 who left, 1/50th, 1/500th, 1/5000th. Now Rashi chooses the 1/5 as the Pshuto Shel Mikra, but that doesn't discount the Medrash. Okay, you're doing your math? How many Jews are we up to? Like the stars in the heaven. Like the stars in the heaven, because you're talking about the opinion of Rabbi Naharoi. If you're going to say that the 600,000, which is not 600,000, not 1.2 million, right? But we're bordering more like on closer to 4 million, 3.5 million. So if we're talking about 3 plus million, if that's only 1/50th, imagine how many Jews. Now imagine even if you take the conservative estimate is it only 1/5. So take that and multiply it, you're talking like 10,000 people. 10 million people, pardon me. So in 210 years, a family of 70 souls produce 10 million people. Again, that's the conservative estimate. Could be as many as 100 million people. That doesn't make any sense. That doesn't fit on the charts. Now, the fact that they didn't leave is a tragedy, but it's the fault of the people. That's not Hashem's fault. They were supposed to choose right. But Hashem made a miracle, and despite the fact that Egypt decided we have to make a final solution because the Jews are a problem, Hashem made it that not only should we not disappear, but we should multiply far beyond what anybody could imagine. Remember that those 70 people who came down, that includes the Shvatim. Now, okay, Levi had a daughter, but I don't know if he had any more children after he came down to Mitzrayim. The tribes already were like big, they were big boys, they were kind of grown up already. And many of them, his wives had passed on already. And we have no record of anybody remarrying. So you're talking about a small amount. You're not talking about 70. You're talking maybe there was 30 or 35 people that were actually capable of marrying and having children. And amazingly, in that short amount of time, we proliferated and we experienced this population explosion. Despite the fact that our enemy said, uh-oh, we have to figure out what to do with our Jewish problem. So that's how we start telling the story. And this is, of course, very profound and very meaningful on a number of different levels, because it explains to us what our origins are. As the famous expression goes, we don't believe in miracles. We live by miracles. This is who we are. Nothing about us makes sense. The truth is that if you go back to the very beginning of the Jewish people, a 100-year-old father and a 90-year-old mother gives birth to Yitzchak. And the Gemara says Sarah didn't have a womb and she couldn't have children. Meaning the first Jew had to be born only after tremendous angst and huge miracles. And then Yitzchak and Rivka having children is also not so simple. Like, it's never simple. It never went easily. It never went simply. But it goes. And we're still here to tell the tale. And that's what we're doing tonight. We sit down at the Haggadah. We're telling the tale. We're talking about this extraordinary reality that is our history and is our essence. Okay, so let's move forward now in the Haggadah. So we know that we're millions of people, and Hashem made us as numerous as the stars. Now it says, Vayihi Shom L'Goy. By the way, the word Goy is not a pejorative. The word Goy means a nation. That's all it means. It just means a nation. There is one Goy Kodesh, the holy nation, is Am Yisrael. And then there are Shivim Goyim, 70 nations. It became a pejorative, but there's nothing pejorative about it. Goy just means nation. In fact, we're called a Goy here. Vayi Sham L'Goy. It was only there in Mitzrayim that we became a nation. That's where we became a nation. That's where we came into our nationhood, into our peoplehood. Now, a lot of different people who have a common origin are still not a nation. What makes a nation a nation? There has to be common denominators. There has to be some way to identify. Otherwise, that's not a nation. In the last century, there were many nations that were artificially hammered together. Yugoslavia, for example, which is the unison of Slavic nations who hated each other's guts. And the moment communists fell, they began genocidal plans, one against the other, nursing grudges that go back centuries upon centuries. Look what's gone on in Syria in the last 4 years. There is no Syrian nation. There are a collection of clans, Alawite clan, this clan, and that clan. They're killing each other. It's not really a nation, because you cannot impose nationhood. You cannot come to people who have different cultures and different backgrounds, different interests and different wants, and say, okay, you are now a nation. There's no such thing. And even if you were to impose such a thing, there would have to be some kind of commonality. The Soviet Union imposed itself on many different countries for 70 years. That's a pretty long time. And they outlawed any kind of expression of nationalism, and the schools are not allowed to teach anything about the individual histories, civilizations, and cultures. And amazingly, when communists fell, within weeks, there was this amazing patriotic fervor that swept across little tiny nations. And each nation was fighting for its self-determination and its own identity. Where did you get that from? 70 years. Didn't you forget about it already? Clearly not. So what does it mean the Jewish people became a nation? And what were they a nation? We didn't have a country. We didn't have a government. We didn't have a leader. We didn't really have a leader. There was no recognized leader of the Jewish people. Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't come and assume a mantle of leadership from somebody. Sure, it says his father was God Ladar. His father was a great spiritual leader. For who? For the tribe of Levi. The Levites, they had allegiance to the Torah. The Levites were never enslaved. And by the way, that's an important little detail we'll see in a moment. But to say that they were a nation, what, by basis of what were they a nation? Well, first of all, we don't know, but what we do know is, the Pasuk says, Vayihi Shom Legoy. That's what the Pasuk says. The verse says that they were a nation there. What does that teach us? If the Pasuk makes such a statement, Melamed, that has to teach us, Shehayu Yitzrael Mitzuyonim Shom, that the Jewish people were distinguishable, set apart. The word Tzion in Hebrew is not a political movement. What does Tzion mean? It means a mark, a distinction, something that is made unique and separate. What does it refer to in Torah literature? Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, or the Beis HaMikdash, because that's the marked spot. That's the place. That's what the word means in its intrinsic essence. So when we talk here, though, we're not talking about the Temple Mount or Jerusalem. These things didn't exist. We're certainly not talking about a political movement. What does it mean when it says, Melamed Shehayu Yisrael Mitzuyonim Shom? That the Jewish people living in Egypt were Zionists? What does it mean? What does it mean, Mitzuyonim? So Mitzuyonim means, very, very simply, that they were distinctive. There was a mark, there was something about them. People looked, oh, that's a Jew. What made them marked? What made them unique? Did they have to wear yellow stars? What made them different? In what way were they distinguishable? So you'll say, well, the Egyptians persecuted them and they made them dress a certain way or they made them be a certain way. No, no, no. That's putting the cart in front of the horse. That's not what happened. First, the Jewish people came into this land and they prospered and they grew. And the Egyptians looked around and they said, Vey Izmir, what are we going to do with this Jewish problem? They're growing so fast, soon we won't exist anymore. We have to exterminate them. We have to figure a way to deal with them. So that was what caused them to set in motion the Egyptian exile, the exile part, or the slavery or bondage part. But to begin with, they were distinctive. What made them distinct? What set a Jew aside from everybody else? Now, oh, okay, you're quoting Medrash, very good. So we're going to get to that Medrash in a minute. In today's day and age, we could argue that what makes a Jew distinct? Torah mitzvahs. We could argue that. Of course, there are people who will argue, no, I said Jewish people are just cultural and bagels and lox is good enough and maybe kibbutz or folk dancing. And I'm going to be the first one to tell you that this doesn't last. All of these kinds of phenomena, they only last two or three, four generations maximum. You meet any Yiddishistin lately? The people used to identify with Yiddish. It was a whole fervor, a whole movement. It filled the whole world with its splendor. It's much more powerful and much more vocal at one time, even than Torah Judaism, was the Yiddishist movement. You know any Yiddishistin? Maybe? A handful? What's the future for Yiddish? If there's a future for Yiddish, it's with Torah Jews, Hasidic Jews who want to speak Yiddish. Secular Yiddish? Gone. Finished. Like any other secular cultural movement. The Jewish people cannot be identified and cannot be held together with secular kinds of touchstones. It doesn't work. The only thing that will work for us today is Torah mitzvahs. And that's historically the only thing that has worked. So in every time there are people who deviate from Torah mitzvahs, and one of two things happen. Either the children come back to Torah mitzvahs, or they simply fall off the face of the earth. That's the reality of our Jewish people. We're living it today perhaps more vividly than ever before in history. But in Mitzrayim, you couldn't say that because we had no Torah. Because we had not been chosen as the Jewish nation. We weren't Jewish per se as we know Jewish today. We didn't even have a history, a national history. We had a family. Okay, it's a family. So what does it mean then? Shahayu mitzuyonim. This is something that, of course, has to be explained. The Mesader HaHagadah simply states the facts. Melamed shahayu mitzuyonim sham. You should know that they were identifiable. They were distinct, and everybody knew there is a Jewish nation. What's left to us now is to try to understand that. What does it mean that they were distinct? What does it mean that they were set aside as a Jewish nation? So, the truth is that the best place to start is with the Medrash itself, because that's the source of everything is from the Medrash. Everybody talks about the idea of the Jewish people and is going to quote this Medrash in a variety of different forms. So I'm going to read to you the original Medrash, a few versions of the original Medrash, and we'll see that it filters down through the Rishonim, the Achronim, and the lessons that we learn from it. So in the Medrash Shir HaShirim it says, with regard to the Jewish people being Mitzuyonim, Rav Huna said in the name of Bar Kappara that there were four things by whose merit the Jewish people were redeemed. Now this cannot mean by whose merit, meaning the mitzvah that enabled them to be redeemed, because we're going to see soon that there's a pasuk that speaks about us being basically naked. And since we were naked, and as the Midrashic interpreting goes, we were naked of mitzvahs, we had to receive two mitzvahs, by dint of which we would merit redemption. So the Medrash cannot mean that we merited as in a spiritual merit, as in we did something good, and in this merit, we were redeemed. That just doesn't fit with what we're going to say in a moment. So what is the meaning of it? So it seems to me, it's not so much an issue of by whose merit, but it means by virtue of what was there a nation altogether. You have to have a nation to redeem. There had to have been a nation for the Egyptians to enslave. By virtue of what was there a nation? In what did our nationhood or our identity find expression? That is the question. And Rav Huna says the name of Bar Kappara, it's first of all, they did not change their names. They remained the Jewish names. The second thing is, they had a distinct language. They continued to speak Hebrew. The third thing is, he says, they didn't speak Lashon Hara, didn't slander each other. And the fourth thing is, he says, that there was a certain code of chastity and modesty that they maintained even though they lived in the most licentious place on the face of earth. And this was the virtue of what made a Jew different. So everybody knew, whether they were the indigenous Egyptians or other nations who had been living in Mitzrayim, oh, those are Jews. Those are Jews. Now, what does this mean? What does this mean that they didn't change their language? So the Medrash goes on to say something very interesting. When Og, Melech HaBashan, comes to tell Avraham Avinu about Lot, I'm taking you back to a story in the very beginning, this fellow Og, really old, he's a historic guy, he goes back to the pre-Mabel time, and then later on he lives and he's a survivor of wars. Moshe Rabbeinu slays him. This is one heck of a dragon. This guy doesn't disappear for a very long time. When Og comes to tell Avram, it says the survivor of those battles, called a Polit, Vayaged, he says to Avram ha-Ivri. Avram ha-Ivri. You know what Avram ha-Ivri means? Abraham the Hebrew. A Yehudi. Mordechai was a Yehudi. Avram was an Ivri. And then it says, when Moshe Rabbeinu came to the Pharaoh and he said, we need to go. He said, God spoke to me. How did he identify God? He said, Elokei ha-Ivrim, the God of the Hebrews. So we see in the Medrash, and then he goes on to say, you see, when Yosef introduced himself to his brothers, he said, I'm your brother. I'm a Jew, and you could see this, can't you? So one interpretation is he showed him that he was had a bris milah. But it says, Ki pi hamadaber aleichem. You see that I'm speaking to you. He spoke Hebrew, naturally, freely. He says, you see, I'm speaking Hebrew to you. Obviously, I'm one of yours. Historically, then, we see the Jewish people did not lose their identity. There was something Hebrew about them. What could it be that was Hebrew about them? If not the language they spoke, because Hebrew is a language. It's still a language until today, even if it's a modern version of it. Okay, they had the names. They didn't change these names. Well, let's take a look at the pasuk. What does it say? Elo Shmeiz B'nei Yisrael, the second book of the Torah, the book of Exodus, begins, these are the names of the Jewish people. And the whole book is called Shmot, which means names. And then we go on to say, these are the names. You say, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. So the Medrash says, When the Jewish people went into exile, subsequent to the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, and certainly subsequent to the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, they came back with different names. People's names changed. And the Medrash says that was different. When we went into Mitzrayim, he says, Lehoya Koirin L'Reuven Rufus. Now Rufus is a Roman name, so the Medrash is using the language of its time. V'Lei L'Shimon Hayikarim Luliyoni. Or it says elsewhere, Yehuda is an Aryeh, they didn't call him Leon. Label is Leon. Yosef, they didn't call Listes. Benjamin didn't get known as Alexander or Alexandra. These were names, for whatever reason, that had a corollary between the Hebrew name and between the English name, which historically, we did develop names like that. Some of the greatest Jewish leaders of all times had Greek names. Antigonus. Antigonus, the Rebbe of the Jewish people, he had a Greek name. Avtalion. It's a conjunction of Aramaic words. So there were many people who had Greek names. That was a common thing. But when they went into Mitzrayim, they came in with those names and they left with those names. So when the Jewish people left Mitzrayim 210 years later, a lot of them were named Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. Those names stayed. The names of the people that went into Mitzrayim stayed. Now it's interesting that not all the names stayed, and I talked about this once in one of our classes. Yeah, I don't think anybody can tell you why some names did survive or some names didn't survive. Ostensibly, all names should have survived, especially if it was the name of a Rebbe or a very prominent Jew, because people would name somebody in honor or after. So how could the name disappear? It's like statistically, it's impossible that the name Menachem Mendel should ever disappear from the Jewish people today, or the name Chaim Mushka. Right? Think about it. How is it statistically impossible? You have thousands and thousands of Jewish children have been born in the last 20, or for the Rebbe, in the last 30 years, and they're all named Menachem Mendel or Chaim Mushka. Every Chabad affiliate family has one. So, eventually, Chas v'Shalom, Mashiach is going to come long, long before. But think about it in theory, right? They grew up, they get married, eventually they die, they have children. Everybody gets named out. How does the name disappear? How come there are no Antigonuses? How come there are no Tarfons? I don't know. But I do know that the foundational names of the Jewish people remain forever. And that was something that the Jewish people kept in Mitzrayim. They had distinct Jewish names. The distinct Jewish names, for all we know, began first and foremost with Avram, Sarah, Yitzchak, Rivka, Yankiv, and Leah, Rachel. These names remained. And all the Shvat, these names remained. These names were continued by the Jewish people. And that's a very powerful thing. A very powerful thing. The Jewish people, it says, did not speak Lashon Hara. What does it mean they didn't speak Lashon Hara? How do we know this? The Medrash says later on, it says that Moshe Rabbeinu said, go and borrow things from the Egyptians. Okay, so let's talk human nature for a few minutes. You know how it is, like you got something and somebody else got something better. How do you feel? You should feel so happy that somebody else got something better than you. That's very nice. In a book, it sounds very nice. In reality, we get jealous because that's human nature. We can't stand it with somebody else. If nobody had, that's fine. But you should have and I shouldn't have and you got better than me. And then, unfortunately, we have done a very bad job historically of running to our enemies and trying to get our enemies to fight our battles for us. Always to our detriment. It's going on now in Israel, and it went on in the Jewish people in the Second Commonwealth, where they got the Romans, two brothers, were busy fighting, two Maccabean brothers, and what happened in the end? The Romans were only too happy to be given a foothold. And the rest, as they say, is our tragic history. Not a single Jew tattled on anybody else. And those who were very defensive. We took care of our own. We remained there for each other. And this is something which, later on in history, we did not do so well at. But when we're in Mitzrayim, but that was a virtue. You know, a Jew wouldn't betray a Jew. No such thing. Would never happen. Halavai was like this today. Especially in Israel. That's how it was then. And that is a tremendous virtue. You could even call it a mitzvah, only it's not a mitzvah. It's just a virtue. It's a virtue. It's a powerful thing that made us be able to identify. And finally, there's this notion that the Jewish people had a tremendous amount of modesty. The one thing we didn't do, the one thing we didn't violate, we violated everything else. We worshipped idols, non-kosher food, there was no bris milah. We did all the things that everybody else was doing. The one thing we didn't do is engage in the immodest culture, which was prevalent at the time. And we know this, the Medrash says, because there's a discussion of one man who goes and he blasphemes. And who is this man who goes and blasphemes? You say, oh, this is the son of Shlomish Bas Divri. She was from the tribe of Dun. And she was struck up a conversation, and she was flirting with an Egyptian, and he cast an eye upon her. And in the end, he rapes her. But that's not... Unfortunately, she opened the door. She's not held guilty. But this is the story that happened. The story that happened. That this Egyptian taskmaster comes, wakes up the husband, throws him out of the house. He says, don't you come in or I'll shoot you. And he goes in and does whatever he does. And she just half asleep, doesn't know what's going on. That's the story in the Torah. So the question obviously is, how could it be that the Torah would tell us something bad about somebody? The Torah doesn't speak negatively about anything or anybody, unnecessarily. And the answer is, Lahaget Shvach and Shal Yisrael, Shal Yinimtza Behem Elazu. Of all the Jewish people, of those 10 million people we talked about, there was one woman who behaved in a licentious fashion. One woman who betrayed the code of modesty which the Jewish people accepted upon themselves. That is extraordinary. That is, you would have expected, especially their slave people, to have no rights. This would be very common. So these were the virtues that the Jewish people were just different. Were different. And the Medrash goes on to talk about that all of this comes from the merit of patriarchy and matriarchy. It comes from the Zchut Avot. The Baba, the son of Kahana, said that Sarah went down into Mitzrayim. She was abducted by the Pharaoh. And what happened? Nothing happened. Sarah refused to let him come near her, and she maintained her modesty, and nothing happened. And the Baba says, in the schus of this, the Jewish woman in the future had the schus of Sarah Yemenu. And what about the males? Did they behave? The Baba says, yes. Not like in the desert where they didn't behave. Here they did behave. Because Yosef was brought down into Mitzrayim, and he was in a very compromising and challenging circumstance, and the Medrash said, what did Yosef do? He maintained his resolve, and he restrained from doing anything sinful. So what does that tell us again? That tells us that because Yosef behaved in a certain way, says the Medrash, that this gave the strength for the future of the Jewish people. And of course, this is a lesson for all of us, that our strength doesn't come just from us. Our strength comes from those who preceded us. We have a background. Am Yisrael has a... It doesn't have to be that they were a physical child of Yosef. That's not the point. Yosef HaTzadik was a leader of the Jewish people. He gave a residual reservoir of strength for the future. And the Pinchas, in the name of Reb Chiya, goes on to say that the pasuk Gano Lachesikala, that my kala has remained chaste. This is a reference to the Jewish people living in the land of Mitzrayim. Okay, so now we know by what the Jewish people were distinct for. This is the original Medrash, at least one version of the original Medrash. The Rebbe in the Haggadah, he quotes the Zevach Pesach, and the Zevach Pesach says that Mitzuyonim means, comes from the word siman. He says misumanim, they were designated, distinguished. Shalishinu eshmam, they didn't change their names. Lashoinim, their language. Dosam, their faith, which that has to mean the notion of chastity and modesty because we did worship idols. Umalbusheihem, and here he adds from the different medrash, their clothing. They dressed distinctly. First of all, it means they dressed modestly. The Egyptians dressed in a very immodest fashion. If you think there's anything modern about today's society, think again. It is simply a regressive society. We're going back to where society has been many, many times before. By the way, society, when it gets this way, it doesn't last very long historically. When it becomes totally immodest and totally debauched, it unravels, unfortunately. And we may be there. The point is that the Jewish people, there was something Jewish about the way they dressed, and the only way we can understand that is with the notion of modesty. Now, there is a version in the Haggadah. Some of the Haggadahs say, Vayiyu Sham L'Goy Godol. There is such a version. And the Rebbe says that in the Machzor Vitri, Avudram, Shalah, in the Yavetz, these various Haggadahs, it does say the word Godol, but in the Haggadah of Reb Sadji Goren, of the Rambam, the Maharal of Prague, Reb Shamshir Akshever, the word Haggadah is taken out. And the Rebbe said, what's the difference if you do have the word Goy Godol or not Goy Godol, big nation or not big nation? The Rebbe suggests that it's unreasonable to say big and then big. It says, Vayhi Sham L'Goy, they were a nation. Okay, so that's it. You said that already earlier, they were a nation. Why do you have, and then it says, Godol Atzum, very mighty, very large. So very large is the next statement. What's the point of saying, Vayhi Goy Sham L'Goy Godol? The point of this first statement is not that they were a Goy Godol, but that they were a Goy, that they were a nation, that they were distinct, that they were separate, that they were apart, that they were identifiable. The Rashbam says that the reason they did this was because they didn't want to assimilate. They embraced the mores of the society in which they lived, but they still didn't want to assimilate. It's a funny thing. So a Jew doesn't have the spirituality. He loses, really, the faith, but he doesn't want to assimilate anyway. Sound familiar? They didn't want to assimilate. And Ashbam says that was what it was all about. So they went. They chose something cultural. Don't be too religious. That's for the Levites. The Levites are religious. We're not religious. That was only, you know, one small section, 8% of the Jewish people, which became much, much less than 8%, as you see in a few moments. But the rest of the Jews said, we still want to be Jewish. We still want to identify Jewishly. Which tells us, actually, nothing has changed in 3,000 years. It's exactly the same way today. In other Rishonim, this is connected to the idea of all of these things that were done specifically, it says, in order to make sure that they would be set apart. Now, it does say, in the Shibuli Halakha, it seems to indicate that this medrash is referring to a merit, but nonetheless, a merit is still not a mitzvah. It's a schus, but in the end of the day, you need more than a schus, you need a mitzvah. Merits are nice, but mitzvahs are needed. So these were merits, they helped us, but a mitzvah it wasn't, and that was not enough to make it happen. Ramban says something very, very interesting. When he talks about this idea of the Jewish people having names, Ramban says like this. He says you should know that the Jewish people, when they go into different places, they make a point usually of trying to maintain their communal identity, and they try to do it in name fashion. And he says something fascinating. He says when the Jewish people were in the Muslim lands, so they had names like Ibn Ezra, Ibn Shushan, or other names like that. In other words, they created a family name, a Jewish name, and that became the identifying mark of the family. Now, you have to know that family names, surnames, did not come into practice till about 250 years ago. At a certain point in time in Europe, and even later in the Eastern lands, there came this notion that you had to have a name. It was census, things were being formalized, and you had to have a last name. So what are the common Jewish names? What are the most common Jewish names? Anybody know? Gold is a very common Jewish name. Another one? Okay, good. Good, gold. How about Schwarz and Weiss? Schwartz, Schwarzman, Schwarzberg, Weiss, Weissmandel, Weisberg, Weissman. Yeah? So it says like this. So some names were pashut, like what people did for a living. A Schuster, he was a living. A Schneider, he was a tailor. But you had to purchase a name. So the cheapest name is black and white. Those are the cheapest colors. It's really, Rabbi Google says that this is actually true. And then there was, you know, there's the names that were the nicer colors. So let's say brown. There's a lot of browns in Yiddish. Like Bruin, green, Greenberg, green. How about blue? Blue is a little less. Blue and red was the expensive colors. You don't know so many Roths. Roth, Rothberg, that's from Reuter. Reuter means red. All right. So less reds and blues, or Blausteins, or right? But they're much more. Yeah, interesting. Gold and silver, somehow the Jews really went for that. They were like really excited about gold and silver. Goldberg, Silverberg. So a lot of names came from this is where names came from. They say the family of Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Ditchever was called Der Barmdiker. Because Der Barmdiker. Der Barmdiker means the great warm love. Why? Because they came to his house in the middle of davening. And he said, the Barim Dikir, he was speaking to his loved one, he's speaking to Hashem. So the guy wrote down, the Barim Dikir. That's where the name stuck. Right? The name of the family of the Rabbeim. So the Tzemach Tzedek, who's a grandson of the Alter Rebbe, his father-in-law, who's also his uncle, the Mittler Rebbe, his name was Shneuri, right? Because his father's name was Schneer. So Schneer became Shneuri. The Alter Rebbe's last name was Baruchovich. Why Baruchovich? Because Ovich in Russian means son of. So therefore, his father's name was Baruch, so he's Baruch Ovich. And that's how a lot of all the Ovich names simply is son of, right? So Tzedek established the name of the family as Schneer's son. Not Schneer, Schneer's son, and that's how the Schneer's name became the name of the family afterwards. But this is, you're talking about the mid of the 18th century, into the 19th century, really. The 19th century is when names start to... But interestingly, in the Sephardic lands, where the Sephardic Jews live in the Muslim lands, Jews had last names long, long before everybody else. And the Ramban talks about this. There's a name, Ibn Tibbon, was a very famous family of scribes. Ibn Gabriel, Ibn Gabirol, Ibn Shushan. These are like clans. And he says they did this. They gave not just first names, but last names. because they wanted to be identifiably Jewish. And very interestingly, in today's day and age, how do you identify people most of the time? How do you know if they're Jewish? From their last names. I never met a Gentile named Kaplan, I'll tell you. It's a I probably never will. And if there is, it's because the father was Jewish and the mother wasn't, right? You know, there's this guy, William Cohen. I don't think he's Jewish. His mother, Caspar Weinberger, was from a big anti-Semite, actually, but he was from an assimilated Jewish family. So there's certain names, but people remain still identifiable. So Ramban says this is an old trick that we have. We have these names, you know, and these names are easily identifiable as Jewish names. So obviously, Cohen and Levi, you know the family. It comes from Cohenim or Levium. There are certain people who have the name Cohen who are not Cohenim. Like, actually, my name is not a real name even, but it means chaplain in Polish. Because most Kaplans are Kohanim. We are not. That's because it's an adopted name and everybody has their stories of where names came from. But the point is distinct names. Distinct even surnames. Ramban says the surnames that we found in the modern era or the Middle Ages into the modern era is a reflection of the names in Mitzrayim. Only then it was personal names rather than family names. But they identified familiarly and communally and nationally by the virtue of the names. Pretty cool? So that's the idea of Mitzuyanim Shem, that they were noted, obvious, everybody knew who they were. Okay. So how did they become so great? How did this explode? Next sentence. Gadol Atzom, amazingly, exceedingly great. How do you know that? Well, it's not how you know that, but it's as it is written. Remember we talked about that? Over here when it says Shenemer, it's not that it's the proof of, but as it is written. As it is written, Kamo Shenemer. Uvnei Yisrael, that the children of Israel, Paru, Vayishritzu, Vayirbu, Vayatzmu, Vimaoid, Maoid. How many words did they use to describe that? The Haggadah? Paru, they increased. Vayishritzu, they swarmed. Vayirbu, they became exceedingly great. Vayatzmu became mighty. Bimaid, ma'id, very, very. Count it up. How many terms do you have there? Six words. Says the Medrash. This teaches us that there were six babies born at a time, also known as sextuplets. So when you have a birth rate with sextuplets, now you know how you get so many Jews in such a short amount of time. And it's actually right there in the words. The Medrash, by the way, records another opinion about how they became so, they multiplied so quickly. The Medrash also says that actually, there's Yeshayimrim, there's another opinion that says that it was not six at a time, but 12 at a time. And that's also taken from the same word, says the Medrash, because it says, paru vayishritzu vayirbu vayatzmu. All of these are in the plural. So since all of these are in the plural, therefore, it says that they became prolific in the plural, multiplied in the plural, exceedingly mighty, land became filled, very, very, in the plural. So therefore, it's not six, but 12 at a time. And now you're starting to understand how the population explosion happened. Now, there is a very interesting question that something that always bothered me as a kid. There aren't that many records of births in the Torah. Small amount of births in the Torah. We record the birth of Yitzchak is recorded. We know about the birth of Yaakov and Esav. It's recorded. We know about the birth of Tamar, another multiple birth, the second multiple birth in the Torah, which is Zarach and Peretz. We allude to the birth of Yocheved, but it doesn't say it openly in the Torah. And the next birth we hear about is the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu. So how many siblings is Moshe born with? None. How many came out with him at the same time? Did he have six? Did he have 12? No, just one Moshe. And Moshe has one brother, and his name is Aaron. And Moshe has one sister, and her name is? What's with the six? What's with the 12? How did that work? So it always bugged me as a kid. So the answer I convince myself is, doesn't mean every single birth was six. It means some births was six, but that still doesn't account for the enormous birth rate. Until I saw something fascinating. What did the Rishonim say? That you know when and how the Jewish people had this extraordinary explosion? Because they were persecuted. As the Pasuk says, and the Rebbe actually quotes this at the end, it says, Kasher Yanu Oso, as they tormented them, Ken Yirbe. That's how they increased. The more they tried to plot against them, the more they tried to destroy us, the mightier we became. There was one tribe that was not enslaved. There was one tribe that was not tormented. Levi. And they have very small numbers. Very small numbers. Levi is counted from birth, from 30 days old. And yet, the tribe is like 8,000 people in the tribe. And the other tribes are like 30, 40, 50,000 in the tribe. So what's going on? How come Levi doesn't have those mighty numbers? They weren't tormented. In other words, like this, somebody will think, I'm going to collapse under the pressure. I can't take what I'm doing with what's happening. You know what? You're having challenges? Every crisis is an opportunity, especially if you're a Yid. If the Eberstein gives challenges, then this is a key to explosive growth. And so when they were tormented, Kasha Yanu Ken Yirba. That's how they exceeded. So for the Levium didn't seem to have this miracle. The Levites was life as usual. It was the rest of the Jewish people that tormented that had this unbelievable difficult challenges, and as a result, had this unbelievable population explosion. Now you know that the idea, it says that they swarmed. So some of the Mefarshim say something very interesting. Yaakov Avinu, he blesses the children of Ephraim and Manasseh. He says, "V'yidgu l'rov bekerav ha'aretz," which is an allusion to dag, to a fish. You know how many fish have a lot of babies? You know, like schools, like they lay a lot of eggs, and like enormous amounts at a time. Swarm. That's how the Jewish people had children. Yaakov Avinu foresaw this, and he blessed them that you should swarm forth. You should have enormous amounts of children, and they did. They had huge families. So this explains to us how it's possible that the Jewish people had such an unbelievable explosion in their growth. Now the Medrash says something else fascinating. Why only six? And why is that the common opinion? Rashi quotes the opinion of six. He says, well, it says, Kasha Yana also Kein Yifrots, right? Mention that. That's the Rebbe finishes his commentary in the section of Agada with those words. Kasha Yana also Kein Yirba. How many days did they work? Because on the seventh day, they didn't work. Because Moshe Rabbeinu convinced the Pharaoh, he said, what are you tormenting them 7 days a week? If you let them work 6 days a week, give one day off, you'll get much more productivity out of them. And that's why it says when Moshe Rabbeinu rejoiced on Shabbos, because he felt a personal affinity to Shabbos. Interesting, Moshe Rabbeinu is the seventh leader. Shabbos is the seventh day. It says, Yismach Moshe, we say in Ashmon Esrei and Shabbat morning, Yismach Moshe b'matnat chelko, with the gift of his portion. Hashem gifted the Jewish people Shabbat. It's his portion. And really, it would then seem that this major explosion did not happen in the beginning. This major explosion only happened in the last few decades of the Jewish people being in Mitzrayim. This was not all along. They came there 210 years. And in the beginning, there was no pressure. In the beginning, it was they were growing in a healthy way. And they started growing more and started growing more. But when it really became unbelievable, that was only when the pressure was ratcheted up. When did things get terrible? The last 90 years. How do you know? Because Miriam is a little girl and her parents separate. So we can't bring children into the world like this. Why should we have children? And then the children will be thrown into the sea, this new infanticide, the genocide that the Pharaoh is introduced. So that's when the Jewish people, the Levites were not exempt from being murdered. They were just exempt from slavery. But that's when things got terrible. So since that's when things got terrible, that's when things really began to grow in an unbelievable way. I'll tell you something else fascinating. The Medrash says that these children who were born, we're going to soon see about these children being born. We're going to talk some amazing psukim from Yecheskel. But that says that those children who were born under the greatest duress, who were survived by the most miraculous way, they were children when they left Mitzrayim. That means when it was so bad, the so bad and dark, the Jewish people were groaning, crying out to Hashem, it couldn't go anymore. That's when Hashem calls Moshe. Those children who were born, those children came to Eretz Yisrael because they were less than 20 years old. The decree was only on the Jewish boys who were over 20. Girls didn't have a decree. The boys, the men had the decree. But under 20, that means that the most amazing miracles happened in the last 20 years. The most difficult time of Mitzrayim was the last 20 years. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't even there. He had already left. He had run away from Mitzrayim decades before. And that's when it was the darkest. And that's when it was most hopeless. And that's when it says the Pharaoh would take a bath every day in fresh Jewish baby blood. Every day the Pharaoh used to take a bath. He would take babies, he would decapitate them, and have their blood squeezed into a bathtub, and the Pharaoh would bathe. Every day, this was his daily ritual. That was the hell the Jewish people were living when Moshe Rabbeinu is, so to speak, encounters God at the burning bush, and Hashem says, "I've heard the cries of the people." So that's the idea of Kasha Yanoisei Ken Yirbe V'Chein Yifritz, which takes us now into the next section of the Haggadah. The next, well, we're still in the same section. The next verse. So they're exceedingly great. They're having this unbelievable population explosion. Now, we very interestingly go all the way forward into the book of Ezekiel. We're not talking about Moshe Rabbeinu talking with Pasuk of Devarim. We're not talking about the Pesukim from Shemot that describe. We're going all the way into Ezekiel, and this is called Back to the Future, because we're going to go forward to go backwards. If you want to understand what happened in Mitzrayim, you have to go forward into the future, far after going out of Mitzrayim, where the prophet is speaking about how life was and the miracles Hashem did for the Jewish people, because he's trying to inspire the Jewish people in a moment of their own low. He says, look where you come from. Don't get demoralized. Don't lose yourself. So the pasuk in Yechezkel says, the Rav, it says they were mighty, right? The pasuk says, Kichech v'ashmaim l'roiv. So what's v'rav? When we talk about this idea of numerous, so he says, k'mosha nemar, as it says, v'ever olayich v'erech mizbeiseses b'demoyich. I passed over you, and I saw you wallowing in your bloods. That's what the pasuk says. V'oymar loch, this is God, prophet speaking, God says, b'demayich chayi, by your blood you will live. B'demayich chayi, by your blood you will live. Now, this pasuk is anything but straightforward. So there's even like a whole discussion whether this pasuk belongs in this section of the Haggadah. There were those who maintained it didn't even belong in this section of Haggadah. And the Rebbe quotes that the Yavetz and his father, the Chacham Tzvi, used to say this pasuk, but they said themselves, they don't know where the source, they don't know how it belongs over here. And the Rebbe asks, what do you mean? There is, the sources, the Siddur of the Arizal, it's right there. And it's in various other versions of the Haggadah, but actually this pasuk goes there. And the pasuk is found in different forms, actually in three different ways where we insert this pasuk. The Rebbe explains that this is the most natural way to insert this verse. Right over here, not at the end, but right over here at this point, we're talking about the Jewish people that they became very, very great. It became extremely numerous. It became extremely numerous was when we were mizbeiseses b'damoyich. We're wallowing in our blood. Now, of course, you must be wondering by now, what in heaven does that mean? What does it mean that you're wallowing in your blood? All right. So let me give you like an overview of the Medrash as the Alshach puts it. Rabbeinu Moshe Alshach says like this. He says, when it came time to have babies, and we're talking the last few decades of the Egyptian exile, maybe even the last decade or two, he says that they were afraid to have a baby because babies would be killed the day they were born. It was like, there was no future, it was impossible. So not knowing what to do, they would go off into the fields, thinking that somehow, who knows, something could be over there. So the Alshach quotes a Medrash and he says that Hashem made a miracle. First of all, how do you give birth to a baby yourself? No help, out in the field somewhere. Hashem said that Hashem would make a miracle, they would fall asleep. And therefore, they didn't feel the pain of childbirth. And the child would be born, and they didn't see this. And then he says, angels would come, and angels would clean these babies. And angels would swaddle these babies. And they would cut the umbilical cord and do all the other things. And they would swaddle them, and they would dress them. And they would be fed, it says, from the rocks. Fed from the rocks. It says there was oil and honey that came mechal mishtzur from the rock. As it says, that's the meaning of the pasuk, ve'enikeo dvash misela. They fed him, they suckled him, honey from a rock. And the mothers had given up on the babies. They didn't even know where these babies were. And they didn't know if they ever see these babies again. In the meantime, as the mothers would say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we're doing our best. You want us to have children, you want us to... We have these babies. They're your children. You figure it out. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu miraculously would save these babies. And these babies, the Egyptians heard that the Jewish people are being born, and they would come to kill them in the field. So the Medrash says, miraculously, the children would suddenly disappear, sink into the field. So the Egyptians came with plows to plow up the babies in the field. This is what the Medrash says. and the blade went down, however it was, 6 inches, and the baby sunk below that. And that's the meaning of the pasuk in Tehillim that says that they plowed over our backs, and the Egyptians thought that everything was finished. These children later would come, sprout from the earth, and this is all you're going to see fits into the pasuk that goes after this, Ravavak et Samach HaSada, that they sprouted like vegetation. And then they came home to their parents later. And miraculously, each child identified his own parents and knew who his parents were. So these are the children born in the darkest and most horrific times. And it says that these are the children who sang Shira first. It says, Hei mi kiru et chilo. When they saw the miracles of crossing the reeds, they said, oh, we know you. You took care of us. They recognized the presence of Hashem. And it says, they sang Hashem's praises, and these babies came to Eretz Yisrael. This is the first generation, the generation that came and conquered the land of Israel for Am Yisrael. And as the Al-Shech finishes off, that Hei Masha Nichnus Al-Aretz Yisrael Im Yoshua, Shalayil Echad Mehem L'Esem Shana. Not one of them was 20 years old when they left Mitzrayim, which means this is all taking place in the last 2 decades. The Heim Iker Hadar, they were the primary generation, Asher Nichnusu La'aretz, who went into the land of Israel. So this is a little bit of midrashic background into what's going on over here. Now, when it says that there were mizbeiseses b'damoich, so there's a literal meaning to this, and then there is a midrashic meaning to this. The literal meaning is, amongst other things, Rabbeinu Bechaya and others say, that the Jewish people were beaten so badly that they were forced to make mortar. And the mortar was made with more of their blood than water. That's how bad it was. That they were forced to step on and to stamp down the straw with bare feet, and it cut into their feet. And, you know, Auschwitz, Auschwitz conditions. And there was more blood in these bricks than there was. So it was mizbeiseses, but they were wallowing in blood. Literally, the bloodletting was unbelievable. The suffering was unbelievable. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes along and says, B'domai chayi. You'll see. Not only this will not do you in, but ultimately from this you will live. So that's the kind of the background of this pasuk of Yechezkel. And you have to understand that we're talking about prophecy. We're talking about the spiritual poetry that Hashem gives to a Navi centuries after going out of Mitzrayim. This is not a pshuta shel mikro pasuk. This pasuk is not found anywhere in the actual description. It's not found in a literal sense. It's all employing metaphors. Was mizboiseses b'damoich? It's obviously it's alluding to something. It's alluding to the idea of some kind of blood. Mizboiseses b'damoich, and vayimulach b'damoich hayi fits with the idea, as we said, kashayano isekin yir bevchen yifreitz. So this is the notion that despite the fact that they had this unbelievable suffering and difficulty and travail, nonetheless, ultimately, they not only prevailed, but survived despite it all. Now, it's interesting that from the words, v'eila shmot, the beginning of the book, until the words, v'atimale ha'aretz osam, right, this is just before Virov, just before we go to the Psukim that speak of the Psukim in Yechezkel. Just from the words, from Shemot, it says over there that the Shainim bring down, the Balatesis bring down, that there are 210 osios. 210 letters, and that's how many years they were in Mitzrayim. In other words, that's like from the beginning to the end, from Vela Shmeis until Vatimale Haaretz Oisem, the land was full, 210 letters. That's the snapshot of the Egyptian exilic odyssey. That's what happened over there. In his commentary, the Rebbe further says that the reason that this is incorporated into the Haggadah, the other psukim that are not incorporated into Haggadah, is because this notion encapsulates the story. It's these psukim that become kind of fundamental on the focus of what happened. It was terrible. We were beaten. Blood was flowing. In the end, everything turns around in a marvelous way. Now, the truth is that there is not only a literal interpretation to this, there is entirely a midrashka interpretation to this. The Medrash says that Masha B'charis used to teach that Hashem said, it's Eiz Doidim, it's the time to take out of Mitzrayim. No mitzvahs. Like we talked about, they had virtues, no mitzvahs. So they needed mitzvahs. So what was the mitzvah, says the Medrash? The mitzvah was they had Dam Pesach and they had Dam Mila. the blood of circumcision. All the Jewish people, the Medrash says, had a bris milah on Yud Aleph Nisan, on the 11th day of Nisan. It's pretty interesting. It's not Rebbe's birthday. Yud Aleph Nisan was the big national bris milah day. And then, 2 days, 3 days later, they brought the Korban Pesach. And it says this was the bloods. B'damai chayi. It's with this blood, the blood of the Brit Milah, and the blood of the Korban Pesach, that you are going to live. So the Rebbe asks a question. Okay, you're telling me that the virtues they had wasn't enough to bring them out of Mitzrayim. It says they were like naked. Assume we're going to use that terminology. Okay, so in that case, why do they have to have two mitzvahs? What's wrong with one mitzvah? I mean, two mitzvahs isn't that much more than one. It's not like they needed 630 mitzvahs or 50 mitzvahs. So one mitzvah, two mitzvahs. You need a mitzvah. Once you have a mitzvah, you have a schus. Why do you need two mitzvahs? So the Rebbe says that in serving Hashem, there's two things. Number one, you have to be ready to let go of the evil and the negative. Number two, you have to be ready to embrace the positive. I'll give an example. Let's say you have a marriage that's on the rocks. Why is it on the rocks? Because the people, the husband and wife are horrible to each other. And the husband and wife say, well, we're being horrible to each other and this is misery, but we really want to save our marriage. So okay, we have to change, to clean up our act, go to a counselor and a therapist, and we have to figure out how to make this work. So he comes and says, she criticizes me a whole day. And she comes and says, he badmouths me a whole day. Okay, says the therapist, will say, listen, you, Mr. Husband, need to say nice, loving words. You need to tell your wife she's fantastic and wonderful and beautiful. And you, wife, you need to say to your husband, you respect him, you admire him, and so on and so forth. Okay, fine, they go home. And what happens? He keeps saying not nice things and nice things. She keeps criticizing and she affirms. They come back, it's not working. Of course it's not working. You have to stop what you were doing. You have to switch modes. You can't just add on. If you have a rotten structure, you can't build on the rotten structure. You got to remove the negative stuff, and then you have to build on something positive. If you have a room that's filthy, you can't just come in and start wallpapering and bring in nice furniture, but you don't clean the dirt out. Clean the room out, bring the nice furniture in. So if the Jewish people would only bring a Korban Pesach, what does a Korban Pesach represent? The Egyptians was Elul Mitzrayim, the sheep, the goat, that was what the Egyptians worshipped. Generally, they worshipped animals. And this they worshipped, so the Jewish people took one of their idols, the big idol, and they slaughtered their idol. What does that show? That they renounced allegiance to this demonic worship, to the worship of animals. And interestingly, the Rebbe says, it says the idea of Shechitas HaPesach, the dam of Pesach. It's not so much the eating of the Korban Pesach. It was the blood of the Korban Pesach. It was take the blood of that which everybody around you was worshiping. You slaughter this animal and its blood gets splashed on the doorposts and on the lintel. That was the main thing, was not the eating. The main thing was the slaughtering of the animal, which represents the renouncing of being immersed in Egyptian culture, Egyptian mores and theology. And that comes along with the notion of affirming their connection to Hashem, which is the concept of Bismillah. Interesting, the Midrashim note that says about Levi, that they held on to your bris, which is Levi never lost the bris milah, and that's also connected to Yeru Mishpatecha, the idea of Torah. The whole Torah is represented with the bris. The bris represents Mesiras Nefesh. It represents an absolute willingness and commitment to Hashem to the point that transcends whatever kind of personal pain. It's irrelevant. The main thing is I'm going to be devoted. This is, it's worth living for this, something to live for. So this is the notion of the two bloods, so to speak. Mizbeises is b'damayich. And Hashem says, b'damayich hayi, b'damayich hayi. The source of life for a Jew is Torah. The source of life for a Jew is Yiddishkeit. So if you let go of the idolatry and you embrace Torah mitzvahs, okay, then you're okay. That's b'chayi. Then with this you can live. But otherwise, if you can't let go of that, then you can't embrace a devotion to Hashem, then you're not going to be able to merit going out of Mitzrayim. And unfortunately, as we learn, many, many Jews, never made it out. So this is the Midrashic understanding of the Mizbeiseses Medamoyech that it refers actually to the last moment. And this section finishes off with further psukim, Revava Ketzema Chasada, that you were as numerous as plants of the field. Which, you know, let's talk about the Alshech, quoting the Medrash. That's the idea we just talked about, right? They were in the fields, they sunk into the ground, they sprouted from the ground. So he says, you grew like wild weeds, one Medrash says. Just like all over the place. There was no way to explain how this was happening. I placed you, Nasatich, Vatirbi, Vatigdili, Vatavoi, Ba'adi Adayim, Shadayim Nechainu, V'si'erich Tzimach, Vat Erim Ve'erio. So this is, I made you as plants of the field. You thrived, you matured, you reached the age of adornment, and you were, so to speak, your bosom fashioned, you became ready to get married, like a kala. You know, you're ready for kala. The problem is the bride is naked. Like some of the mafarshim say, the Jewish people living in Mitzrayim didn't have decent clothes to wear. But in a midrashic way, there was no mitzvahs. Everything was ready. It's all in place. No jewelry, no clothes. I mean, it didn't work. So this is when Hashem came, when we were naked, and when we're in this situation, then Hashem gave us the mitzvahs. And that's why, by the way, the Rebbe explains you have to take the Korban Pesach and tie it to the bedpost for 4 days. We don't find this later on with the Korban Pesach. You bought the Korban Pesach probably right outside the Beis HaMikdash or went into and brought your Korban Pesach. Why do they have to bring it to the bedpost and look at it for 4 days? Because remember, you're living in a situation where for centuries now your family is worshipping these animals. And you tied animals, so you actually know this animal. Okay, it's got a name. You know him. You look at him. You go to sleep at night and the animal's blinking at you. You wake up in the morning and he's looking his big eyes at you. And you feel like, I can't kill this thing. I know him like him. And then you go and say, no, he's not a god. He's just an animal. And then he made a shechita of a Korban Pesach. Oh, that's real renouncing of Avodah Zarah. So when the Jewish people who were in this situation, where, as we learned in all these beautiful ways, came from a situation miraculously, grew forth, sprouted forth in the ground, everything was prepared. Everything was ready. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us these mitzvahs, and by giving us these mitzvahs, that's how we were able to merit redemption. Which, what does it tell us? It tells us, first of all, the power of a mitzvah. It tells us that we, on the end of the threshold of the geula, the Rebbe said, what do we have to do? We have to try to make sure that our fellow Jews get dressed. Every year has merits, and every year is wonderful and beautiful. The problem is, a lot of them are spiritually naked. Gives an epis a mitzvah. A mitzvah becomes a garment. A mitzvah becomes an adornment. A mitzvah becomes that which enables us to leave galus mit the galus and to go into geula. And just as it was then, so it is for us today as well. And in our current state, the more we're able to give mitzvahs or levushim, the more we're able to give garments for a klal yisrael to be able to address and adorn itself, the more we are able to hasten the coming of Mashiach Tzidkenu. It's very interesting that in the Rebbe's perspective of outreach, as the world calls it today. So for many people, outreach means you make people frum. That's what it's about. But the Rebbe never focused on making anybody anything, any frum. He said, be mezakeh, make Jews meritorious. But he did a mitzvah. People laughed. They said, ha, 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 you met a Jew in the street, you put on film, he didn't know what happened before or after, you gave a Jewish woman a candlestick. Big deal, said she got a... So maybe she lit a candle once. What does it mean? What is it? First of all, there are the hundreds of thousands of stories today, which we know about, of entire lives that have been changed from a single mitzvah. From somebody who had a lulav and esrog thrust into their hands, and everything changed. We don't even know. And sometimes it's not even somebody who said no. No, I'm not Jewish. I'm not Jewish. And he started thinking afterwards, and the whole life changed because a yeshiva bachur stopped and asked him, are you Jewish? He didn't even have a chance to do a mitzvah. But secondly, even if it's not going to change, the fact that a yid has a mitzvah automatically gives him a levush. And that's being mezakeh, to make Israel meritorious, to make Yidden meritorious. And the more we're able to share the merits of spirituality, the merit of mitzvahs, the closer we come to that great day when we will experience redemption all over again. And it says the miracles will, Emir Hashem, be far, far greater, as the prophet Micha says, just like you went out of there, it was miraculous. And the interpretation of our sages is that not it'll be miracles like then. It'll be miracles in comparison with those miracles. And it was just like those miracles were abnormal and paranormal beyond what you can imagine. When Mashiach will come, Emetz Hashem, the miracles will be that much greater. We just have to follow the program. And follow the template. The template is making sure that Yidden have those levushim. And with these levushim, we're able, Emetz Hashem, to be zeicha to Geula Hamitis Vashlema.